All right. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Nick DiGilio here. Overnight dude till 5 a.m. every weekday morning. Two for Tuesday coming up. So get your requests in for Two for Tuesday. Text them in to DJ Shagru there at 312-981-7200. Also, text in or call in any and all space-related questions that you may have. 312-981-7200. Because my guest is an award-winning author, he's a journalist, and he is a speaker about space. And he's written many books, and we'll talk about that and more, and all the new space news coming up right here when we welcome Rod Pyle to the show. Hi, Rod.
Hey, how are you?
Good. How are you, sir?
I'm very good, thank you.
All right. Now, I don't know about you, but there was a lot of people last night looking at the sky and checking out Mars.
Yeah.
And what was the reason why we could see it so clearly last night?
Well, it's actually for a number of weeks, and that's because it's making its closest approach to Earth, which it does every 2 years. This one's about 47 million miles away. 2018, it'll be more like, I think, 34 million miles, but it's still good.
Yeah.
And, you know, because of the Earth's orbit is inside Mars's orbit, every 2 years we catch up with it and we get a nice close view. So that's why it's kind of big and red and bold, and it's right overhead at midnight. So that's cool.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. I checked it out last night, and it was pretty good. Now, how long is this going to last? A couple of weeks, you said?
Yeah. It actually hits its closest approach on May 30th, and then it'll start to travel away from us in mid-June and eventually work its way back out to its furthest point on the other side of the sun. And then 2018, it'll ramble on back, and hopefully that's when Elon Musk will send his rocket up there, which is what we all got our fingers crossed
that's
for.
That's what you're all hoping for, man, huh? Now, is there, like, for at a time like this, like when, you know, when like every 2 years when Mars is closer to the Earth than usual, do you guys throw parties? Do you guys have viewing parties? Do you just kind of, is it like party time?
Gosh, I wish I had a good answer for that. You know, I worked up at Griffith Observatory in L.A. for 10 years when I was younger, in my 20s, and we did. I mean, after 10 o'clock when the park closed down, we had the building to ourselves as long as we were there so we could stay up there all night, and they had a great telescope, big 12-inch refractor, so we'd stare at Mars and have some possibly alcoholic beverages and a few other things back in those days. But
see, you guys know how to party. You space guys know how to party.
Well, back then, yeah.
Yeah.
There was always a paucity of women. You know, that was the problem with space guys in those days. But I think that's changed. They seem to be much cooler now.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, you know, I'm not calling you a nerd, but that being a nerd is cool now. But so, no, seriously, yeah. Rod, the tide has turned. It is now it's now cooler to be a nerd than it is to be like a jock or anything like that.
Well, I think it's cool to be a young nerd.
Right.
When you're in your 50s, you know, it's kind of less. I mean, you still don't have your dress code worked out. And it's like, oh, did your mom pick out that nice button-up sweater you got? It's a little less, you know.
I know what you mean, man. Yeah. I'm going to be 51 in about a month or so, and I still, you know every line of dialogue to the movie Halloween. So I'm, you know, I'm also I'm a nerd in a different way. So
okay. So given that we're kind of in the same age range, can I ask you a movie question?
Of course you can.
Scale of 1 to 10, Maroon, 1969.
Oh, I love that movie.
I do.
I haven't seen it in years, but I remember really loving it.
You know, I'm a member of a couple of online space groups, and one of them, there's a woman who loves that film, and she was raving about it. And I only saw it when I was a kid. I think I was 12. And I remember at the time thinking, that's not how space works, and this and that, and all. And it was kind of the last gasp of the old studio movies with visual effects. So they're, you know, the guys are obviously hanging on wires and all that. But the big problem was an astronaut cried.
Oh,
astronaut Gene Hackman, put me off Hackman forever. Is whining about, I broke the washing machine, they won't let me fix it, and all this stuff. And I thought, oh, man, you just lost me. But on a dare from her, I rewatched it. It cost me $3 to rent it on Amazon, I think.
Yeah.
And I have to say, that aside, that Gene Hackman moment aside, which still kind of made me grit my teeth,
yeah,
it was so close to the real deal. I mean, the blinky lights went on when they were supposed to. They didn't just have these big panels of Christmas tree lights going off and on. Everybody staring at it going, look at that, it's a Delta V. And I mean, the patter between the launch director and the guys at the consoles and the capsule was accurate. They actually got people to write the real stuff for them and all that. So it was sensational. Oh. I had forgotten all that.
I hadn't seen it in a very, very long time, but I remember really liking it. So that's good to hear. That's good to hear. Do you have a favorite movie that is about space or anything like that, sci-fi film?
Well, we've already talked about Independence Day, so I'm not going to bring that up. Because I know what you thought of that. You know, I mean, as a kid, seeing 2001 wasn't quite what I expected.
Yeah.
When all the paint started blending and he's going through the Stargate of Jupiter and all that. But I have to say, as the first, for my money, and I later worked in the visual effects industry and really learned what a big deal it was that they did for my money because of the scale of the models and the way they shot it and the way they handled everything from going to the moon to going out to Jupiter. The effects work was so good, and being able to see it back in those days, of course, in 65mm film.
Yeah.
It was a jaw dropper, and I believe I saw it in the theaters. I think I counted 22 times.
You know, and it was
that's nerd.
No, yeah, absolutely. But I mean, for people who have not got to see, I've seen it on the big screen. I've seen it in 70mm a few times, and it's spectacular. It is absolutely spectacular. But one of the things that people don't remember, Rod, is that when that film came out, hippies would drop acid. at a specific moment in the movie where they knew the acid would kick in during the last 15 minutes.
Right.
And then they would drop acid about an hour into the movie, you know, and then it would kick in during the last 15 minutes, and they would go down to the front of the theater and lay on the floor on their back and watch the screen. And that was a phenomenon that was happening across the country, like people dropping acid and laying on the floor in front of the screen for the last 15 minutes.
And you heard dozens of people down there going, whoa. In unison. But, you know, is it really any weirder? I taught college for about a decade, and while I was doing that, the movie Titanic came out. And one night, a bunch of my female students came up and said, can we leave early? I said, sure, what's going on? I said, well, our crying club is going to Titanic. And I said, you're what? So they would sit, I guess, in the front row or somewhere together, hold hands, and then on the proper cues, they would all cry together. And I thought, okay, well, that's a different kind of nerd.
Yeah, that's
romantic nerd.
That's much less cooler than what they did in the 60s, I got to say.
Yeah. It doesn't require any drugs.
Rod, yeah, it's true. Rod, hang out, okay?
You bet.
All right, Rod Pyle is with us, a great award-winning author. You can check out pylebooks.com, P-Y-L-E-books.com. We have a link on our Facebook page. We have a lot of space news to get to, and if you want to jump in with any questions, it's 312-981-7200. News next. Hey, good morning, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Studios on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower, overlooking beautiful Michigan Avenue. And we are here till 5 a.m., as we are every weekday morning, 2 to 5. And coming up a little bit later on, we're going to have a round of I Just Don't Get It. That's where we're going to be talking about stuff that everybody else seems to love, but we don't. Like, you're the only person that you know that doesn't like this stuff. And it could fall under any category. Any category. Food, drink, fashion, actors, actresses, TV, music, movies, whatever. We'll get into that. If you want to text your stuff in, 312-981-7200. Also, 2 for Tuesday is coming up, and you can make your requests now at 312-981-7200. Rod Pyle is with us. He's an award-winning author, journalist, expert on space, and we're here to talk more stuff with Rod. Hey, Rod.
Okay.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about I find this really fascinating. The space shuttle fuel tank. All right.
Yeah.
You're getting excited already, man.
Well, I went out. I saw them bring it into the port here.
Right. I know you covered it.
Yeah, so that was great.
Tell everybody about this, and why does it take so long? Explain, you know, what this is and what just went down, and you covered it.
Yeah, so the California Science Center, which is downtown Los Angeles, has been putting together a space shuttle exhibit for years. So they got... And I think it was 2013, they brought Endeavour in, so we all ran down to cover that. So that made its tortured trek through Los Angeles with lots of trees being taken down and power lines. A little bit of acrimony over that, but in general, it was a great scene. People had a fantastic time. I was in right down where near the riots started back in the 90s, which, you know, is a neighborhood that some people avoid. But at that time, that it was, I think, 3 in the morning, everybody was out there for the same reason. It's a wonderful thing. I saw people that really, I interviewed a few of them. They really didn't even know what the space shuttle was, but they knew it had been to space. It had NASA and the American flag on the side. It was beautiful, and they were just there bawling like babies. And I thought, this is great, you know, because this is really that moment where people realize what it is. So that was them bringing the shuttle in. For this particular exhibit, they want to be the only one in the world where they're going to mount it vertically. So to do that, they had to have the shuttle. They had to have the solid rocket boosters in the side, which they've gotten a hold of a couple. And they were going to build this 154-foot-tall external tank to mount it on. But then NASA said, you know, we've got one left over that was built at the same time as the one we used on Columbia. And because of the Columbia accident back in 2003, they pulled it out of the line for usable tanks and used it for testing because they were testing the foam on the thing because they thought that was the culprit, which it turned out to be. So they had this leftover tank, and they said, we'll give it to you. You just got to get it to where you need it. So they loaded it on a barge at New Orleans, and it made a 5,000-mile trip down through the Panama Canal up the coast of California and then pulled into our friend of the marina over Marina Del Rey, and it was quite a sight. And getting it off that barge and onto the pier, which is where the dock there, which yeah. where I was stationed, was quite a show. It was slow, but you could see the thing moving. So they had the barge, and they had this metal ramp, and then to smooth the exit, they had all this wood they had built up to make this little additional ramp. And, man, it sounded like the biggest batch of kindling going up I had ever heard of when it hit that thing. And the tank was twanging and bonging and echoing and all that, but they got it off, mounted it up to a big rig, and towed it across town on Saturday.
And they had to they towed it across at 5 miles per hour. Is there a specific reason why? I mean, they didn't go above 5 miles per hour?
It's just for safety, yeah. You know. And then those are the straightaways. And they came to the turns because of its length. They slow way down.
Yeah.
The last thing you want to do is swing wide with a shuttle tank. And, you know, it's
yeah.
something that flies.
Yeah.
So it's heavy. It's 65,000 pounds. But it's still this big hollow chunk of aluminum with a couple of tanks inside. So you want to take your time and be careful. And that's why you go slow.
Now, were people following along like a parade? Were people, you know, were there people following?
Yeah, it wasn't quite like when Endeavour went through, it was like the Rose Parade, which I've seen more times than I care to remember because
yeah.
I live in Pasadena,
right.
where it's, you know, 40 people deep on both sides of the street. That was what Endeavour was like. When the tank came through, there was probably, you know, ranks of 3 and 4 people deep, but there were lots of people there because they wanted to see it. And it's this big orange thing. I mean, it's an amazing looking item. And at some point, they're going to bring the two solid rocket boosters are up in the high desert up at Edwards Air Force Base. They're going to bring those down by truck, and we'll get to see those. And that'll be a different experience because those look like rockets. You know, the
yeah.
ET, the external tank, looks like a kind of a long, stretched-out pumpkin. But these things, the solids, look like real rockets, and that'll be our last fun moment until I think they're planning to get the building up somewhere between 2018 and 2019. And like I said, it's going to be a launch configuration, so that'll be quite a scene.
So the time frame is like 2018 or 2019 to have the thing up and ready to look at?
Yeah, I mean, they got a lot of money to raise. I think they've got $160 million or so, and they need to get up to closer to $280, so they've got to get some money. But they've got the space cleared out right in the middle of Museum Square there, and they're going to build this big building to house it. Right now the tank's just sitting under a cover, and haul it up there. And if they haven't asked me for my opinion yet, but I'll say it here for the first time. But I really would love to see, because I saw a shuttle in the late 80s and out there getting ready to launch. It was the night before, and they let us take a press bus out to look at it. That's how long I've been doing this. And, you know, they had, just like that old film with the Saturn V, they had all the searchlights on it, and there's all this liquid oxygen, liquid hydrogen boiling off, these white clouds. Now, if they could do that, they bring in some of the guys down the street from Universal Studios and say, okay, give us some stuff to boil off and give us that sequence spotlight thing going on. That would be sensational.
At least just for the opening.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, just like the opening, just for the opening. Obviously, you know, once it's all set up, just like, but when it's the opening night, do it up. I'm with you, Rod. That would be completely amazing.
Okay, let's start a campaign.
All right, let's do it. Yeah, let's do it. But, I mean, it's going to be breathtaking either way, you know, even if without all the effects, just to see that thing?
Well, and they're always sensational to see, but seeing it vertical is going to be a real different experience. I think one of the payload bay doors is going to be open because they've got some cargo in there you can see. I don't know exactly what configuration they're going to have to be able to get up close to the top, but they're all a little different. You know, some are parked on their wheels, some are kind of held up at an angle like they're reentering, and you can see them that way. And, the lighting is always sensational. They're really nicely put together. But I think they're really going out on a limb here to do something special, and I thought that was really inspiring.
That's pretty great. Was it fun covering the fuel tank coming ashore?
Can I be shallow?
Yeah.
Okay, it's always fun getting to go past the fence. you got your press badge, your NASA badge, or whatever it is for that particular event. It's like, yeah, I'm covering that. Okay, go on. They're not impressed. They just want to get you through there so they can get to the next guy. But it's fun going in there, and it's great, because getting close to any space hardware is just a really different thing. When you go to the museums, you can get up to within, depending on where you are, anywhere from 20 to 80 feet away and look at these big monster structures, and they're best viewed from a distance. To be able to actually go up and look close and say, when you're looking at the shuttle in a case, this thing flew in space a whole bunch of times.
Yeah.
It's just put the real lump in your throat. And it's something, not to campaign too much, but it's something the U.S. does very well. We really led in space for a long time. The Soviet Union led in their way. We led in ours, getting to the moon. And it's something that we learned the hard way, and we did a fantastic job, and we're still doing it. But in the last few decades, it's the really visible parts of it with people going up and slowed down. And it's going to be exciting to see, especially with what SpaceX is doing, to see it really come back to the fore.
Now, we got a text here that kind of relates to this, Rod. 773 area code sends in a text. I read the European Space Agency is going to set up a moon village. Two questions. How would that work, and where does the United States program rank against other countries?
Those are great questions, and the answers are a little vague. We have expressed support, but not necessarily financial. So I think the idea is, as I've read it, in the NASA press releases anyway, look, we've been there. We know a whole lot about going there. We know a lot about being on the surface, driving around, prospecting. We know a lot about the moon. So we'll help you in every way we can, but we're heading to Mars, and that's really our obsession at the moment. The head of the European Space Agency said this, I think it was first brought up about a year and a half ago, and it's been talked about since then. And it's not the first time it's been mentioned. I mean, there have been plans. I just wrote a chapter for a book about a moon base that was pitched by von Braun and his guys back in 1959, except it was going to be staffed by Army soldiers that had nuclear bazookas and stuff. So that was a whole different deal. That's a fun story in itself. But they've got a lot of work to do. I mean, the funding is the biggest culprit, of course. That's the thing they have to conquer. And they've got to get all the member EU countries behind that, and that's going to be a trick.
Okay. Here's a question for you about I wanted to mention the Kepler telescope. And
yeah.
It's you're finding – it's still finding things. Now, it was launched in 2009, correct?
Yeah, and then it had problems in 2013. A couple of the reaction wheels, which are the gyroscope mechanisms they had to keep it aimed, went out. So they had to get clever and kind of reinvent the mission to work with two gyros. So it can still be pointed, but it has shorter observing times. It's a little more limited in what it can do. But the big news that came out about the 1,284 new planets verified was actually looking at data from the original observing period when they were staring at a given spot of space for 4 or 6 months at a time.
Over 1,200 exoplanets.
Yeah, and I mean, and that's just the new haul. There's thousands more. I think the total verified at this point is up to 3,200. 20 years ago, there was zero. We thought they were there, but nobody could prove it. And it's not all Kepler. They figured out ways using Earth-based telescopes. And you're looking at this pinprick that's anywhere from the nearest one's about 4 light years away to over 1,000 light years away with these small Earth-based optics. But they've just gotten so clever about it that they're able to detect these very slight variations either in the spectra of the star or the amount of brightness that's coming from it. And that tells them whether there's a planet about Earth size or larger in orbit around it. And that's just... It just bends my brain to even think about that.
It's absolutely crazy. I mean, it is incredible. And I mean, I was reading this, and it's there are a couple that are actually larger than Earth. And
yeah, there's a bunch. Most of them tend to be.
Yeah.
I don't really know whether that's just because they're easier to spot, or it seems to be just the nature of these others. So there are things that they're beginning to see that saying, okay, we're seeing this again and again. We're seeing that mostly solar systems, or a lot of them anyway, have something like Jupiter. They've got a couple of big gas giants there. They've got these large super-Earths, and a lot of the ones that are being observed are much closer to the star than our Earth is. not exactly sure at this point whether that's because they're easier to find, because they have faster orbits, and they therefore, you know, go across the surface of the star from our vantage point more frequently, or whether that's just how the whole big game is laid out. But it's been amazing to watch this unfold.
And they're still looking for an alien Earth or an Earth twin, and that's not happened yet. But that would be a monstrous breakthrough, correct?
Yeah, it would be. And you know, they've seen planets that are good candidates, but it's tricky because it depends on, you know, how much is that star like our sun? Is it hotter? Is it cooler? And therefore, the planet that we're looking at has to be the right distance away to get about the same amount of light over the same period of time. Some of these planets are looking at the super Earths that are closer into the star, or what they call in tidal lock, which means like Mercury, one side of that planet faces the sun all the time, so everything there is going to cook and everything on the other side is going to freeze. Mm. So you could live right on the terminator between the two, but that would be tricky. But some of the other ones do have day-night cycles like we do. So it's really a matter of, I think, in a couple of years, the James Webb telescope is going up, and that's kind of our super Hubble that's going to go up and start a whole new observing program. With that, they'll be able to actually start looking at the atmospheres of these things and try and figure out what they've got.
Yeah. Okay, Rod, fascinating. Hang on, Ken. Hang on a second, okay?
You bet.
All right. Rod Pyle is with us. You can check out pylebooks.com, P-Y-L-E, pylebooks.com. And we'll talk a little bit about the books that he's written and how you can get them. That'll be coming up. We've got more space stuff. We got texts coming in at 312-981-7200. More with Rod coming up after we take this break. Good morning, everybody. How are you? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Two for Tuesday. Get your requests in. We'll start playing them on Two for Tuesday. Pick an artist, two songs, and those are the music bumps that you'll hear coming back from commercials and breaks and stuff. 312-981-7200. That's for your requests and for questions for Rod Pyle. If you have a question for Rod, space-related, 312-981-7200. Rod, welcome back. Are you there, Rod?
I'm here.
Oh, okay.
Yes, I am.
I just wanted to make sure.
Sorry, take a little nap there.
Okay. Okay. Tell everybody about some of the books, your latest book. Let's talk a little bit about your latest book so people know about it and how to get it.
Well, I've got, the last one was about the Curiosity rover. It was simply called Curiosity, and that was been out for a couple of years. And then this year I've got three coming out. One's called Mars Making Contact, and it's a big picture book about U.S. Mars program from its origins to about 2023, I think, is when it drops off. Another one's called Blueprint for Battlestar, the Science of Sci-Fi, and that's one of those, hey, it's weird, you've heard about it, you've read about it, here's the truth, you know. So how close are we to having jetpacks and flying cars and starships and that kind of thing? So
right.
That was an awful lot of fun to do.
Right.
And the last one is called Amazing Stories of the Space Age, and that's going to be about some of the stuff I was mentioning earlier, the early ideas about can we put a military base on the moon and can we use Gemini spacecraft to intercept and disable Russian satellites and all that kind of stuff. So it's a lot of either things you didn't know about things that flew or things that almost flew but didn't, but are really cool.
Very cool. And all the information is at pylebooks.com, P-Y-L-E, pylebooks.com. And we have a link on our Facebook page at facebook.com/NickDShow. Now, Rod, I don't know if you get antenna TV where you are. Do you get antenna TV?
I do. I just bought one about 6 months ago.
Because the channel, Antenna TV, they show Johnny Carson reruns. And I bring this up, and they do. I watch it every morning when I get home from work. I watch they're classic Tonight Show episodes, not just, you know, Karnak bits or stuff like that, but full shows with full interviews. And I've been watching them. They started this in January, and I've literally watched them every day since January 1st. And
you are hardcore, my friend.
No, I got to tell you, I love them. And one of the best guests ever who has showed up repeatedly in these reruns in the 70s and into the early 80s so far has been Carl Sagan.
Yeah.
Always absolutely brilliant as a guest on Carson, and always reminds me of how great that man was. And so if you get a chance to watch some of these, because he's a pretty regular guest on the show, and I've forgotten how many times Sagan appeared on that show.
Well, he was one of the first guys of his kind that really made that circuit. You know, he didn't have the Mr. Science bow tie thing going for him. He was the real deal. And I think part of it was he was just so eloquent. You know, if you read his books, he writes like an ancient poet with a modern sensibility.
Yeah.
And his ideas were, as you know, so big, and yet he never lost that human touch. He really knew how to reach people in their hearts. And that's the thing. You can talk about numbers and how many stars and how big the planet is and what we've been able to deduce and so forth and hardware, which I love to talk about. But he really knew how to make it human and make it touch the emotions. And that's what I think made him so incredibly special.
Yeah, he was amazing. And it's every time, you know, like at the beginning of the show when they announce the guest, if Sagan is on, I just get very excited. I'm just like, oh, Carl Sagan, awesome. He's great.
And
one of my favorite interviews that he did on Carson was, it was right after Star Wars came out. Okay. And which is so much fun to watch these things as like a piece of history. Like yesterday's episode had William Peter Blatty on 3 weeks after The Exorcist opened. So it was it was at that time when everybody was fainting in theaters, and it was just to watch this piece of history unfold, it was amazing. But anyway, Sagan was on a couple of weeks after Star Wars came out, or a few months after Star Wars came out. And so Johnny asked him about Star Wars. And the one thing that he said many things about it, you know, whether it's scientifically accurate, things like that. But he said that the one thing that made him very angry about Star Wars, he said he enjoyed it. He thought it was, you know, entertaining. But the one thing that made him very angry after watching it was that Chewbacca did not get a medal at the end like everybody else did.
Oh, my God. Speciesism. I hadn't thought of that.
That's exactly what he said. He said that.
Having to watch Mark Hamill for 2 hours made him sick.
That's what he said. He said it's speciesism. And I about fell off the couch. He's like, hey, I'm so mad that Chewbacca didn't get a medal. I was like, that's outstanding.
Well, that was probably kind of touchy territory back then because we were still going through the throes of all those upheavals politically.
Yeah.
And, he was a brave guy.
That was brilliant. Gerard says, can you ask Rod Pyle about Planet X? In 1965, I was told in school that Planet X orbited the sun opposite to Earth, and therefore we could never see it. Is that true?
As far as anybody knows, no. And there's a couple of good reasons for that. And, of course, you and I probably both saw Journey to the Far Side of the Sun.
Yes.
So we know how it's supposed to work, right?
Right. Right.
And the polarity is reversed on the spacecraft, so be careful. But, you know, it's really well understood at this point how the planets move in the solar system. So if there was one on the opposite side of the sun, we'd be able to deduce from the motions of the other planets that there was this effect going on. That's one thing. For a more direct kind of empirical observation, NASA launched a couple of satellites in 2006 that were trailing and ahead of Earth in its orbit. They're far enough laterally removed to be able to see between the two of them across where that orbit would be. And there's been other probes that have gone to other planets and other parts of the solar system that probably would have been able to see it over their shoulder. So at this point, there's no evidence of it, but never say never, right?
Okay. Now, we were talking about Mars a little bit earlier, and there's a story that says Mars might have had massive tsunamis at one point.
Yeah, and, you know, this is just part of this unfolding saga of water on Mars that we've been hearing for almost 20 years now, and it's a great story. You know, this was a really active, possibly verdant planet billions of years ago, back when Earth was just kind of getting its start in terms of having some kind of stable ecosystem. Mars already had these huge volumes of water, by some estimates enough to cover it in 30 feet of water today, just if you melted all the ice. Apparently, according to this theory, 3.4 billion years ago, there were these huge tsunamis, probably caused by meteor hits, and we're talking about, you know, meteors, something in the order of miles across, great big things. But it was enough that it covered the northern hemisphere of Mars is where they think there might have been this ancient ocean that would have been rather Earth-like, cold, salty, but an ocean of liquid water nonetheless. So it had a denser, warmer atmosphere that would have allowed the water to stay fluid and all that. But they're looking at these, what they think are ancient shorelines, these areas that they call lobes that look almost like frozen wavefronts. And they see boulders that they estimate are about 30 feet in diameter that appear to have been moved by this water over areas between 300,000 and 400,000 square miles. So we're talking about great, big, nasty waves, you know, hundreds of feet high, moving in across vast volumes of that planet. So if that is the case, it's a really compelling argument for just how wet the place was. And there's been other, you know, this is the latest in the series of things. There's an article that came out when I was doing some work over at Caltech by the people there based on the last couple of years of stuff that had come down from Curiosity. And again, now they're just down the Gale Crater, but that was submerged in water for a very long time, a couple dozen million years, maybe 100 million years before they're talking about these tsunamis. So there's all kinds of, there's a huge book being written somewhere about just that story of water being moved around on Mars.
Yeah. Wow. All right. Well, what are you looking forward to on the horizon, Rod? Any developments?
Well, we got on July 4th, we got Juno, which is going to enter orbit around Jupiter. And it's not a camera mission this time. There is a camera on it, but they're not really, you can only learn so much by staring at cloud tops. The scientists want to know what's at the core. So they've come up with these really ingenious ways to measure down deep beneath all these roiling clouds and figure out what's there. They think that there's a core, possibly at the very center, of rocky material surrounded by hydrogen that's so compressed that it's actually turned into a metallic liquid, which is a form that you don't see around the corner, right? It's a very rare, weird thing. So they're talking about measuring, as the spacecraft orbits Jupiter, they're going to be looking at any changes in its speed due to gravitational effects in this core on the order of thousandths of an inch from Earth, being measured just by radio science.
Wow.
And that's another one of those things. You sit in these meetings with all these, you know, PhDs in their 30s and 40s thinking, how did you end up so smart and I'm sitting over here? You know, that's just not an equal distribution of IQs. But they're definitely, you know, out on the far end of the bell curve and I'm on the other side. So wow. I just listen and kind of sit in awe. But so that's going to be an amazing mission.
Okay, cool. Rod, always a pleasure, man. It's always a good time to have you on. I appreciate you hanging out with us so late.
Anytime. Thanks again.
Okay. Rod Pyle is the best. He's an award-winning author, journalist, and an expert on space. Pylebooks.com, PYLEbooks.com. We have a link on our Facebook page. News is next on WGN.